Welcome to Are You at Risk, a podcast from Minnesota Lawyers Mutual Insurance Company. Here are your hosts, Todd Scott with Joy Melvin Griffin and Kiernan Waters.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Are You at Risk, the podcast about legal malpractice and all the things that can go wrong in a law practice. I am Todd Scott, the Vice President of Risk Management at Minnesota Lawyers Mutual, and I'm here with always my very best colleagues, Kiernan Waters.
Hi, Todd. Glad to be here.
And Joy Melvin Griffin.
Hey, Todd.
Hey, guys. Glad to be here again and take on another topic with you guys. I think these are kind of fun to do. Fun for us because usually everything we do, either we got to get all dressed up and stand in front of a big group of people and talk and they're going to get credit for it, and or we're out there, you know, trying to get our jobs done. But this is just the three of us talking about all the things that a lot of times people ask us about when it comes to professional liability and legal malpractice. And today's program is going to be about that. It's about frequently asked questions. What are the things that keep people awake at night that they ask us when they see us? Well, it's always lawyers. It's never anybody who is just a casual person. It's always lawyers, and then they find out what we do for a living, and they start asking us questions about legal malpractice. And when I tell somebody who's a doctor or somebody who's in the medical field that I work in professional liability, I'll get that scowl kind of look, mm-hmm. you know? And I don't, has that ever happened to you guys?
All the time.
Oh, yeah. You know,
or you're a lawyer and you get that scowl, you know? Mm-hmm. But I don't really get that from lawyers when we say that we are in professional liability for lawyers. And if anything, we get sort of this fascination like, oh, you guys see all the bad stuff, you know, and usually they want to hear about, you know, what it is that comes across our desk. Sometimes it's very typical questions. We're going to talk a lot about the questions that we get most asked frequently, but then also it's sometimes they're questions that stop and make us think. And so the question I just wanted to get started with and throw it to you guys is, I think one of the jaw droppers when you start working in this area is how expensive these cases can get. And so I was going to put that one out there first for you guys. Do you, you know, what is a, you know, one of the most expensive malpractice cases, either in cost of just to defend it or to settle it or a jury verdict? Anything come to mind?
I can tell you that I've seen several cases that are very similar in nature, and it really comes down to the area of practice. Whenever I see construction law, especially for commercial real estate, that is always going to be high. One of the things that, and I know Kiernan and I have discussed this and just speaking with people that we see, is when we talk about limits and the things that you need when you're looking at a policy, we always say, what is the likelihood that you would butcher an entire case, right? Well, in some of these areas of practice, it's kind of high. So especially if we're in wills, trusts, and estates, I mean, one simple mistake could cost someone's entire estate or maybe a beneficiary's in gift. And that could be high depending upon the amount of the estate. But when you look back at that construction law and especially those commercial buildings that are going for millions, if not even a billion, you know, billions of dollars in jobs, I mean, you know, one simple mistake could cost that much money.
Yeah, I agree. And I, you know, going back to the estates and trusts, that being my background in particular, I wanted to harp on that. The everything that's going on in that world, including the changing tax laws, the constraints and all the issues that come with the baby boomer generation, you know, the amount of money that's being passed down now by the baby boomer generation onto others, that has just created a perfect storm of a lot of issues. And I think we all joke, you know, many attorneys joke about how we went to law school because, like, we don't have the mathematical skills. So when it comes to doing the math, especially for tax consequences in that area of practice, I mean, it can go wrong really quickly and have really far-reaching and really expensive consequences as a result. Mm-hmm. So that's a big one right now. And, you know, you mentioned some of the medical malpractice that like doctors experience and how they're kind of like, ooh, malpractice insurance salespeople. You know, luckily, yeah, we don't get that. We get the like, ooh, tell me the juicy details, you know, you know, those types of questions. But when it comes to this, you know, we are seeing some maybe not nuclear verdicts that they're seeing in the medical malpractice world, because that's the big scary thing in our industry right now. Everything's gotten so expensive. And I mean, everything has gotten so expensive, right, in this world in 2026. And there is concern about these nuclear verdicts, which are what, verdicts over $10 million that we've been seeing an increase of, but across like the whole insurance industry. So I don't think that in the malpractice world, we're being hit that hard with those, at least not at Minnesota Lawyers Mutual, knock on wood, you know. Mm-hmm. But we are seeing, you know, $1 million claims, like everything's gotten more expensive, and that includes the claim expenses and the litigation cost and the settlements, all of it.
Yeah, I think it's a great point that you made about there. Just even if there's not much there, just the expense of these things, costs of an expert witness testimony, anything that involves, you know, if it's a marriage dissolution or an estate matter, you're going to often need somebody who's getting paid hundreds of dollars an hour.
How do we get those jobs? Why are they calling the three of us to be expert witnesses? Right. Come on.
Yeah, what did we do wrong? You know, it's a good point, but it's, I think the ones that are obvious, are the most expensive are the ones that I think most people would understand that to be, like anything involving people's finances, securities law, intellectual property, everybody's idea.
I was going to mention that too.
Was $1 million idea. And so if you don't get the European patents done on time, all of a sudden the claim is $1 million. And the first lawyer I ever saw that was $800-$900 an hour, that's probably nothing compared to now, but $800 an hour was, you know, an expert witness in IP law, you know? Mm-hmm. And so the bill can get racked up pretty quick, even if nothing went wrong. And that's why it just carries on to everything else. Some of the things I think that have surprised me the most are things where I guess we're in storytelling mode here, but one of the first times I worked on a debt collection matter, and this was kind of new as a type of claim, but if you read the Fair Debt Collections Practices Act, it says it's $1,000, you know, is the penalty per instance or whatever. And so, and then, you know, somebody wrote a letter, a Dunning letter that's got, you know, there's things wrong with it. And so we're like, okay, it's just a, how expensive could this be? It's a bad letter. Not realizing that, wait a minute, the trend is not just to sue the person over the letter. It's to then tie our policyholder up in court to figure out and depose them. How many of these letters have you sent out over the last 5 years? Oh, you know, thousands, okay. So, you know, and suddenly next thing you know, you're talking $1 million claim, multi-million dollar claim that is class action. So some of these, even though I just remember realizing that, hey, there's nothing that's cheap in this world that we can get out of it that way. So, but yeah, things are expensive. Maybe we should just go back to, you know, some of the basics, and then we'll work our way into some of the important lessons that we also learn when they come from these things too. But so, you know, when we're hearing about these things, we'll just get some of the basics out of the way. What is the most common mistakes that lead to malpractice claims against lawyers? I guess if you look at just the, you know, we see these charts that break them down into categories. And so in the substantive errors is almost half of the claims are just on that part of the pie, which means the lawyer thought they knew the law and they didn't. And so, but in there, it could still be multiple types of claims, including missed deadlines and things like that. But I don't know, Kiernan, do you have a an answer that comes to your head when people say, hey, what are the most common mistakes that I should be worried about?
Well, great point on the missed deadlines. I mean, I think it's so interesting that we continue to have missed deadlines and calendaring issues at such a high rate, despite all the legal tech that we have adopted in the last couple of years. I mean, the legal world is not known for being like, you know, advanced in technology. So the last couple of years with the remote work and kind of forcing our hand, especially with the AI stuff, like I'm surprised and impressed really at how the legal world has more quickly evolved because of that pressure. But, you know, a couple of years ago, I would never have thought that the legal community is, you know, really tech savvy. But we do have all these. I mean, Joy and I were just at a national conference recently, and to see how many vendors were there in the legal tech software space was, you know, really incredible. But, you know, despite all these, you know, Clios and things of that nature, we still have issues with the missed deadlines and the calendaring issues. So, you know, the advice I give now is that you need a human to oversee the tech, and you need the tech to oversee the human error. And you just need, you know, two pathways going forward at all times, which seems redundant. And that's the point. But you'd think that the legal software would have had more of an impact. And the other thing I noticed, just to give a shout out to Maryland's bar counsel, Tom DeGonia, who's a great guy, great attorney, and doing a good job in his role as bar counsel, which is, you know, not an enviable job most of the time. He always says, you know, the three big issues are cash, communication, and competency. Now, he's handling the ethical grievance side of things, where we're doing that in addition to malpractice claims. But, you know, one of the things he says in that the three C's, the cash, communication, competency, is, you know, no one ever writes to his office and files a complaint because the attorney was too communicative, right? That's not something that he hears often or ever, right? It's always an issue that, you know, the expectations weren't there, the communication was lacking in whatever way. And one of the other things I notice about that in recent years is kind of this, like, not scope creep, but like representation creep, where clients want the attorney almost like a 24/7 chatbot that they can reach out to and, you know, talk with the actual attorney, not the AI chatbot, to get answers. So not only is, like, you know, scope creep a thing that we've been dealing with in the profession, but now this just like expectation creep, I think it's been called, is also something that's resulting in malpractice claims as well as ethical grievances against attorneys. And I don't know who's on the right side of that. I think attorneys do a great job, but with the, you know, the Google machine out there and ChatGPT now, it's kind of hard to compete with those other sources where people are, you know, for better or worse, turning for legal advice.
Hey, Joy, with the client communications issue that Kiernan brought up, it does seem like it's a trend, and I don't know. I mean, I guess we could talk about the technology and things that have allowed clients to believe that they can contact their lawyer and work with them at any time, or have, you know, immediate turnaround expectations and things like that. But I'm just wondering, Joy, if you have any thoughts about what do you think is led to this, or are lawyers, you know, creating a situation where they're allowing their clients to believe that they can be accessible 24/7.
I think we started going downhill as a legal profession when we started to give our cell phone numbers away.
Preach, Joy. Absolutely.
One of the things that scares me the most, especially in working in claims, is that when we were trying to prepare the attorney to meet with defense counsel and even, you know, give defense counsel a little sneak peek into what they would represent the insured on, you know, especially for bar complaints, we would say, hey, provide us with a copy of the file. We can look through it. We can see. Well, you know, they would provide us what they thought was a copy of the file. And then we would find out later, hold on, you're missing a lot of communications. And those communications are text messages. Okay. So all of those things become a part of the client's file. All of those phone calls that you get should be logged into your system just as if they were calls coming into the office. And then you know, I always make the joke that I look at my private practice life in the past and I say, oh my gosh, there are so many mistakes that I probably made. And some of those mistakes fall back into, you know, I would have a log and I would say on May 6, 2026, I spoke to this client, telephone calls to the client. Well, what about the description? What exactly were you saying, or what questions did the client have for you that you were able to answer? Because when you go back, now you can say, no, we addressed this. Some of the other concerns that I...
Well, Joy, yes. Let me ask you a quick question, if you don't mind.
Sure.
You know, when you had that client call, you put in the note in your file. Did you send a follow-up email? Hey, client, we just talked about blah, 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 next steps, or you'll hear from me, or whatever it might have been.
Absolutely.
Was that part of your practice?
Absolutely. I will not deny the allegations set forth before me. However, what I will say is that is a good practice right there. Mm-hmm. Not only notating the file, but yes, following up. And it's something that I even do now, regardless. Mm-hmm. I don't care if it's my kids' teachers. As soon as I get off the phone, I'm like, okay, you know, FYI, just to let you know. So that is one of those things. But that is where I think we started to, you know, kind of shift the whole client communication and say, we will be accessible because now you can have my cell phone. Even those law firms that provide cell phones to their attorneys, that's fine. But just make sure that you're able to retrieve those messages and that we're still logging those phone calls. But yes, that is when we started the problem of the accessibility and turning it into, now we have clients who have the expectation that even midnight, we're going to answer that phone.
I think some of these really do fall into the category of rookie mistakes, too. Uh-huh. The things that are most likely to happen to new lawyers. You hardly ever meet a seasoned lawyer who's going to let some client contact them using, you know, personal text and things like that, if that's not what they want to be doing. But I think sometimes newer lawyers feel like that's part of offering good service and things like that. You know, and I just say to them, you know, good service is doesn't necessarily mean you have to be at their beck and call. Good service is just creating, you know, a good understanding about how they can reach you and what's the best ways to do it, and that includes what time to do it as well. So, but it doesn't mean that good service means you got to be, you're sitting home I'm watching Timberwolves basketball.
Oh, I bet you are.
Yeah, I've been trying to figure out a way to sneak that in here. But if you're sitting at home watching, you know, something, and then clients are texting you and expecting replies. So on my list of frequently asked questions, like I said, sometimes there's questions that go that are towards rookie mistakes, but this has more to do with, are there some mistakes that are most likely to happen to solo or small firm lawyers as opposed to bigger firms? And what kind of claims do we see most often against solo and small firm lawyers? The way the question is asked, all lawyers tend to make the same kind of mistakes, whether they're big firm or small firm. But I think the systems issues, Karen, that you brought up earlier, I think we tend to see that a lot more in small firms as well. And when I think about this one, I work for an insurance company, so sometimes I got to geek out on stats here, so hold on to your hats. But there's this pie chart I like to show when I'm talking to groups of lawyers, and it has to do with claim activity based upon the size of the firm. And I always show that next to another chart that shows just basic lawyer demographics. And so what it shows is that, you know, the biggest piece of the pie is solo attorneys reporting claims. And about a third of those lawyers are the ones reporting claims are solo attorneys. And so it stands out. You're like, oh, my God, what are these solos doing wrong and all of that? But then to put it in perspective, you got to look at that against, you know, what how do they make up the demographic of lawyers in private practice in the United States? And they make, and the statistic is half of the lawyers in private practice are solos, but they're only reporting a third of the claims. So what sometimes people think are this solos are a high-risk group, you know, we've known for a long time that no, these solos tend to know what they're doing. They tend to stay in their lane and focus on what it is that they do. And then to continue on with the chart thing, if you get into the bigger firms, they tend to have really good systems. And so they tend to work on high buck matters and stuff, securities law and IP law and all that kind of stuff. But they roughly end up being about an even risk. But there's this group of lawyers in the middle, 2 to 5, where they make up about 15% of the group of lawyers in private practice, but they end up reporting about 30% of the claims. And so it's been way out of whack for a while. And so it makes you go, what's wrong with these group of lawyers at about 2 to 5 that they're reporting a disproportionate amount of claims? And it's all about the office systems. And it's actually about their personalities too. If you get a group, we've seen those, where you've got 2 to 5 lawyers together, they act like a group of solos. And so they don't often know what's going on in the person's office next to them. You know, that person does estate planning, but all of a sudden they took on a car accident case, you know, and they just thought it was going to be slam dunk case, easy money, things like that. And so they might not have peer review and things like that. But you can't do any of that at a larger firm. It is stay in your lane. We focus on what we know. We've got lots of support. We have peer review, other people looking at our stuff too as well. So anyway, so what are you, any thoughts about these group of smaller lawyers and advice for them?
I see exactly the same thing you see where, you know, you think about the solos and it's like they're probably juggling a million plates and riding a bicycle and keeping their firm together and, you know, doing their family life and everything else. And so you could understand how when a claim does arise, you know, something just fell through the cracks, right? And then with those bigger firms, yeah, they have, you know, such infrastructure that allows them to have forms and mentorship and oversight, as well as really well-seasoned paralegals and administrators. So, you know, like they just have the structure to avoid some of that. And when I see claims from those larger firms, they tend to be more expensive claims than the claims that a solo has, right? So there's not more exposure, but there's more liability possibly for the scale of the claim, right? But then, you know, with those, and it certainly depends. You know, I know lots of great 4 or 5 people firms that do, you know, all do family law and operate really well together, but that really takes effort. You know, these are the firms that are, a lot of them are women-owned, if I'm being honest here, or majority women firms, and they take the time to do team building and have, you know, weekly lunches together and talk about all the things that are going on. Whereas, especially nowadays, if you have a you know, 3 to 5 person firm where you don't have a centralized office space because people are working remotely, well, that's when you have a group of solos who are, you know, under one law firm heading, but they're not working on the same things. They don't share the areas of practice, and they're probably not getting together in person or otherwise to review and talk and strategize, as well as think about the firm's expansion. So where they might have, a lot of solos don't have the resources to invest in that structure or the softwares or the help that the big firms have. And these, you know, in-between firms might not just have like the vision to do that if they do have the resources. That certainly depends on the firm as well. But they might not see the value in, you know, they might not align on how the firm structure should go. Grow.
I just want to piggyback on what Kiernan said. I love team building. And the reason why is, you know, we could look at this as, oh my gosh, this is such a waste of time. I already know these people. Why do I need to do that? But if we strategize.
We're talking about team building, not golfing.
Right, right. we must strategize. I think the problem with the firm culture, especially if this can be done in the small to mid-sized firms, is getting together once a month at a minimum just to go over company policies. And I'm not saying, you know, that we have to always talk about the stuff that it irks us or icks us out, like the sexual assault policies. I'm not saying that. I'm saying, like, focus in on how we're going to do client files. Focus in on how we're going to file some of these. Are they going to be cloud computing? What are some new products that we've seen out there in the market that maybe can benefit our firm? What's our hardest case that we've got going on right now? Do you need assistance? Remember rule 5.1 and 5.2 and 5.3. We're supposed to be supervising. So at a minimum, we should be having these meetings to find out what we can do to help not just new associates, but people. Let's not take for granted that just because you've been in practice for 20 years that you don't need assistance. And so I think if we just start to humanize and empathize, then we'll realize, okay, we need each other in order for this firm to be great. And you get what you pay for. If you invest in your employees, if you invest in taking the time with your firm, then that's how your firm prospers.
Mm-hmm. With that, I'm going to take a quick break. That was a great summary of this. And when we come back, I'm going to... Lawyers do weird things when they find out they're getting sued, too. So we're going to talk about that. Okay, we're back. And I mentioned right before this break that we've all been there. We got the call from some lawyer who realizes that a client's mad at them. Well, the question that I'm looking at here says, do lawyers who get sued for malpractice realize that they made a mistake before the claim arrives? That's a funny one, you know, Kiernan, because it is, you know, I think they... deep down in their heart, they do realize, but sometimes they're in denial or something like that. And as lawyers, it's in our DNA to think we can solve every problem. And so if we sit and think about it long enough, that we're going to resolve it. But then eventually something comes along. Hopefully they're not waiting to the point where they're actually served with papers or something like that. But that they're, you know, that they realize, okay, this client's mad. I better, that falls under the definition of a claim. So, you know, what are your thoughts, Kiernan?
I mean, I'm going to have to go with the, you know, the lawyer answer of it depends. You know, if you miss a deadline, you're made aware of that pretty quickly, either by, you know, opposing counsel sending you that text message. Are you coming to the hearing today? Or, you know, the judge reaching out and said, where are you? Are you running late? Or something along those lines. Right. So a missed deadline comes up, whooshes past you and you go, huh, probably should have been aware of that. What am I going to do now? First, contact your insurance carrier. But there's other things, you know, with my background in estate planning, there are documents that I drafted. I didn't go into the tax law, so, you know, I don't have to worry about my mathematical skills too much there. But there are documents I drafted, and I hope my clients, you know, are keeping those in a secure location and are still doing well and are healthy enough that they haven't needed to pull those out. But when they do, you know, there's a potential that something got messed up in the document. You know, of course, I mean, I did everything right, so who knows what could be alleged against me. But it depends on that area of practice and the type of error that is alleged against you. So, you know, it really could be anything.
Yeah. Joy, you see lawyers that have trouble comprehending the fact that they might have had an error or somebody's mad at them about something. And, and also to having to talk to lawyers about, convince them that, no, this is a claim. You need to report it. I don't think lawyers often know to... Well, one of the reasons you got to report it is you got to lock in your coverage. These are claims made policies. And if you've known about this thing, and especially if you start trying to resolve it on your own, and then it takes a turn for the worse, if it could get to a point where you may not have coverage anymore that applies to it. So what are your thoughts?
Let's preface this by saying, when I was in private practice, I represented murderers. I represented those who were convicted of robbery, other heinous crimes.
Wow.
My most difficult clients have been lawyers.
Not surprising to me.
And I think it goes into what you were saying initially. Lawyers have a way of saying, I am an expert in the law. So if there is a matter against me, I feel confident enough that I know what to do to fix it. And the problem with that is I am a lawyer, but I dare not understand anything about tax law. I don't like math, as Kiernan alluded to earlier. So I am not going to say I'm an expert in a broad category when I only specialize in, or I shouldn't even say specialize, but I only practice in one area or maybe a couple of areas. And so if legal malpractice is not the area that an attorney frequently practices in, they should know that this is something you need to allow the professionals to take care of. So as soon as you find yourself in a legal malpractice situation, that is where you call your malpractice insurance company so they can get the professional, which is the defense counsel, to help resolve the issue. Waiting too late, yes, according to most policies, can result in a denial of the claim. So now you are stuck with the one person who can defend you, who is not a professional, yourself. Not at least in that area of practice. And if you do look for the professional, now it's not going to be covered and it's going to come out of your own pocket, which could cost thousands of dollars. So it's we just need to be mindful of as attorneys that, yes, we are considered experts by a lot of people in the law, but then there are certain aspects of the law that we just have to say we don't know enough about to handle.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And defense work in general is so specialized. I mean, criminal defense versus, say, medical malpractice defense versus lawyers' malpractice defense. I mean, they're completely different processes, different information, different everything, as I'm sure your experience, you know, informs you, Joy, right? Are there any overlaps other than, you know, maybe going in front of a judge in a courthouse from criminal defense to malpractice defense for attorneys? And the other thing, you know, to go back to our policy and the importance of claim reporting, but we also encourage the reporting of potential claims. We want to know as soon as possible if something seems to just be going a little off track, if people are just a little unhappy. I mean, you know, get us in there early so we can do claim repair, which is so important to, you know, de-escalate the situation. So you don't have to wait until you realize, dude, that's a big mess up. You know, if something just seems off, you should be able to report it to your carrier to, one, lock in that coverage, but then get assistance moving forward so you don't have to go it alone.
You know, Joy, I'm going to I used to handle claims. It's been many years. Joy, you've done it a lot more and more recently than I have. So I'm going to ask you, you know, for the people out there that think it's assuming it'll be the worst day of their life that they have to call and report a claim, ask you what it's like, and maybe it's not so bad. One thing I recall is almost like being a counselor or a therapist for people on the phone. And there's this statistic that I learned when I first started doing this a long time ago. Frankly, I don't know. I'll have to, you know, study it again to find out if it's true or not, but it makes sense, which is that you're likely to have three malpractice claims in your career.
It's actually gone up.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah. According to, was it the last ABA study? I don't know where I saw this data, but yeah, it used to be like, I think 3 to 5 was the statistic you're referencing.
Okay.
And
yeah.
Now for attorneys who are entering the profession, it's like 5 to 7, maybe even 7 to 9. I mean, it's really shot up there. And when I talk, you know, we talk a lot about, Joy and I talk a lot with younger attorneys, you know, new to practice.
Yeah.
And some of them, you know, look at us with those big eyes like, oh, I'm never going to make a mistake. Don't ever, I'm not, you know, I don't even want to think about it. I'm never going to be. And we're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. You know, like, it's really one, it is just part of the profession. And that goes for doctors and engineers and anyone who has this kind of, you know, practice. So it's really just part of the profession. And we also know that the vast majority of claims are unsubstantiated, lack merit, go away, mm-hmm. are abandoned by the claimant without penalty. So a lot of the times there's not a negative outcome here. It's just, you know, someone throwing something at the wall and trying to see what sticks. And unfortunately, the attorney gets involved. But, you know, for younger lawyers especially, it's just, you know, it's not the worst day. It's probably going to happen to you at some point. Here's what you do. Don't let it, you know, derail your day, your week, your year, your career. It's just, you know, it's kind of par for the course, right?
Mm-hmm. Joy, what do you tell them when they were calling to report a claim?
It goes back to what you were saying. You know, we are therapists, and I think, you know, I know on my degree, I'm sure yours probably says the same, the license, it says counselor, counselor at law. And I take that seriously because it does appear as though we counsel them, but then we help them through it. So the first time or the first thing I have talked with an insured, even as a regional director, and they, you know, say, hey, I need to report a claim and I just got this in and I don't even know what to do. I say, calm down. It's okay. It's okay. You're not the first person this happened to. You're not going to be the last person this happened to. We can help you with this. I'll direct them to claims. And even when I was in claims, I would say, let's go over everything first. Let's back up. Let's pause. Let's start from the beginning. And then we gather the information. And as they walk through it, I'll be honest with you. Some of them will find, this is where I mess. Oh, this is what they're talking about. Okay, maybe I sent them this email. This is where I forgot. Because a lot of times when people are calling, you know, we live in a litigious society now. So they're like, where is this coming from? I don't even understand what I did wrong. Now, for, you know, a lot of them, they'll say, I know this client is just not happy with me, or I know I missed the statute. But for a vast majority, they're saying, hey, this kind of like blew me. I have no idea where this is coming from. And so, you know, we walk through it and they say, oh, okay, I kind of understand. And I say, okay, we can get defense counsel on this. Now they're starting to take that sigh of relief. And then they say, okay, how much is this going to cost me? Well, we say, well, it depends. You know, what happens at the end? Maybe this will trigger a deductible. If you're with a great insurance company like MLM, you know, we've got first dollar defense. You might be in there like swimwear, right? Not having to pay anything. So, so it might be one of those things where nothing is triggered, or even for your supplementary payments coverage could cover your ethics complaints. So then they're taking an even bigger sigh of relief that my purpose in that initial phone call is, yes, to gather the information, but it's to make them feel at ease. Because the last thing you want to deal with is an insured whose anxiety level is at a 9.5. They cannot give you the information you need to successfully defend them or be able to, you know, at least share the important information with defense counsel. So bringing that stress level down is essential in that initial, you know, communication with them.
Absolutely. They just want to be heard, right? You know, they, like any client, like any litigant, you know, they want to have their side of the story told and kind of, you know, they get emotional right away. And I think it's funny, we were just talking with our kind of team of account managers who do such a great job in assisting us and so many in the company. And they always kind of feel a little uncomfy, I think. They were kind of complaining about it, but also like they just want to help, right? They want to provide the support when someone calls, and the calls they get are, okay, so here's the situation. And then the attorney is just word vomiting, you know, well, this was this person back in October, and then they email me, but then it was, you know, and it's not even the claim, it's the, you know, and the account managers were saying, you know, they kind of get stuck on the phone because they don't want to be rude and like interrupt. But at the end of the day, like we have to get them over to our claims department and get the information we need in the right way and keep that file kind of separate from our side of things. And there is just a process, right? And so, you know, when they're on the front lines taking those incoming calls and it's, okay, well, here's the situation. This is what I need to tell you and blah, 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 blah. And like 15, 20 minutes later, they're like, okay, well, I'm going to connect you with our claims department now. Mm-hmm. You're going to have to repeat all this to them. But people want to just get that information out. They feel so much better after kind of dumping the scenario onto the table like that. And then, you know, the claims teams does a great job when they pick up from there and they, you know, start moving forward to provide that relief that Joy was talking about.
You know, that's a great point. It's a burden. They don't even realize they're mm-hmm. carrying it. But suddenly when they get to talk to somebody else about it and they can get it off their chest and then a fresh set of eyes can help look at things and realize, hey, wait a minute, this might not be as bad as you think, stuff like that. Those are the nice times where you really feel like you are doing good for the profession when you're helping people like that out. But I, for one, if I was having a really bad day and had to call and report a claim, I hope I get somebody on the phone like you, Joy, or you, Kiernan, to help counsel me off the ledge there too as well. So, hey, we're at the end of our time, but this actually leads to some other discussions that we're going to have coming up, including what to do with really difficult clients too as well. So we're going to talk about that next time.
We don't have any of those. I don't know what you're talking about. Difficult clients. We love our clients.
No, yeah, yeah. If you're listening, clients, we love you. So don't call and give us a hard time. No, just give. Anyway, so with that, thanks everybody. And we'll see you next time.
Are You at Risk is hosted by Todd Scott, Joy Melbourne Griffin, and Kiernan Waters. Production support by Carol Greethurst. Music by Audio Beats. Recorded and edited by Beth K. Gibbs of Lyft Podcasting. For more information, visit mlmins.com. That's mlmins.com.